Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2019. I am now here on this the sixth night, the second hangout, and I'm here with Mark Collett. Now, Mark, it might not be immediately obvious, but not only has he attempted to emulate my sinister lighting, but he's also wearing... I'll show everyone what you're wearing, Mark. He's wearing a dressing gown. So... in keeping with my own aesthetic. So, although this, I should say, this isn't technically a dressing gown, this is actually a shawl, which is really cozy, and you can get it yourself on Amazon. All right, so, welcome Mark Collett to Millennial.
Hello, it's good to be here. I think this is my third year of Millennial now, so...
I think you might have been on in 2016 as well, although I'm not sure.
No, definitely not. 17, 18, 19, so...
Right, Okay, 2017 was the first really big one. Okay, so welcome back. And you've had a very good year. Would it be fair to say that?
I think it's been a very good year for the movement, especially coming off the back of sort of 2016 seemed to be like the big year for the movement. And after that, it kind
in America,
of had a,
definitely.
Yeah, it kind of, well, also in the UK because we had Brexit, didn't we?
Yes, yes. That's
and
true.
I think after that, things almost, I don't want to say stalled, because that sounds a little bit too negative, but we sort of failed to capitalize on any of those big wins. And some things that felt like big wins at the time, especially Trump, really haven't felt like big wins in the long term. I mean, Trump seems to have walked back everything he initially said. He hasn't really got anything done. I mean, he still has a dedicated base of fans who think he's doing everything perfectly well and everything's coming into fruition. And this is just one big game of sort of 4D chess where eventually he'll end up clearing the board in one move. But I don't really see it like that. And I think 17 and 18, as I say, things just didn't turn out the way we wanted them to. But I think 2019, especially here in the UK, we've made huge, huge strides towards a real world movement. And I think for the first time in a long time, we're having the kind of credible meetings, gatherings, conferences that the people on the continent, the nationalists on the continent, have enjoyed so regularly. And I know that you yourself have been a big name speaking on the continent, and you've enjoyed traveling around Europe and speaking at all these wonderful meetings. But
well, that really happened in 2017, and yeah, that was very busy that year. For and 2018 as well, yeah, to an extent. I think I've done only four conferences this year, something like that. But anyway, go on.
No, I was just saying, you've been to all these meetings, and these meetings are really well done. Everything about them is very professional. The numbers of people at these events seems huge compared to the sort of numbers that we were getting here in Britain. And it always seemed like a real shame that so many Brits were having to sort of travel abroad just to get to a good nationalist meeting. I mean, when I spoke in at Skansa for the first time, I was a little bit ashamed because you had all these Brits flying over to Sweden and like, oh, we came over here to hear people like yourself, people like Colin speak, because nothing's happening in the UK. And I think that's something that we're finally putting right now.
You stopped speaking just as I was vaping.
Maybe that was tactical. Maybe I'm trying to save your life, Colin. But it's better than a cigarette. That's a real improvement.
Exactly. I'm transitioning to vaping. So, you know, I deserve some credit. And it's Parma Violets, which is actually quite nice. Anyway, yes, of course. The Erkin brand, the one that you first came to, Stockholm, in the end of March, was, I think, that was the best one that I've been to. They've all been good. I've been to four. And they've all been good, but that one was really good. Really sort of nice venue, and everything worked out well, apart from the fact that Jared Taylor couldn't be there because he was deported. He was banned from the Schengen zone. But everything else, it was great. And I gave the Hope Not Hate speech, of course. And that was a particularly, and therefore, it was a particularly inspiring conference for you to be at. You know, I think that would have been a very good template for you to, it would have been inspiring.
Well, that's the meeting that made me decide that we had to get something started in the UK. We had to act. Something had to happen quickly. We were already holding small gatherings. We'd had meetings at Christmas. We'd had a sort of inaugural camp that you came to. There was only 12 of us at the first one. And I realized that, you know, we needed to really put our foot on the gas. And now here we are at the end of 2019, and we've had a sold out meeting with 100 people present. We've got two large conferences ready for next year already. And, you know, we're doing our best to get a proper structured movement set up. I mean, you went to one of the Christmas meetings. I mean, the Christmas meetings were fantastic. And I think doing things in this professional manner, and doing it in a way where normal people feel so welcome and they're not put off when they walk into the room. That's how I felt at that first scan. So I walked into that room and I was like, wow, this is the kind of venue you want to hold a meeting at. These people look fantastic. Everyone looks normal, well-dressed. And it just didn't have the kind of stigma attached to it that meetings in the UK have had in the past.
Oh, absolutely. And your inaugural speech at the PA conference, you went into this you spoke about that guy. I mean, it's definitely a thing. It's definitely, I don't like to say it, but it is something that I think needed to be addressed. It needs to be acknowledged that, you know, nationalism in Britain has had a bad image because a lot of the people involved in it have not been, you know, the most vocal ones are often not the best people.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think there's been things that have been started up in the past, which have been kind of promising, but then just so that they would grow slightly quicker, or because somebody didn't want to offend like one of the known misfits who goes to every meeting and has been doing so since the 70s, but every time he turns up at a meeting, he's drunk or obnoxious. These sort of groups or these organizations have fallen into disrepute very rapidly. And I think the important thing is setting sensible targets that you can actually reach and not being so desperate for immediate kind of like meteoric growth, so that you don't need just to get bums on seats by hook or by crook. You know, grow in a very controlled manner, and you can deal with that growth. If you try to grow explosively, like say like the EDL, I mean, look at the EDL, that grew out of nowhere, it exploded, but as quickly as it grew, it died away.
Oh yeah, I don't know how long you would even say that it had in its heyday. I think maybe a year, 2 years, not long at all before it immediately started to deflate.
Yeah, and you look where it is now. I mean, take, for example, another party. I mean, I call these parties, and this isn't, I don't want to get into like any arguments with anyone, so this isn't a slight at the people who are involved in it now, but I call these parties zombie parties because they were once very sort of large, living, healthy organisms, and now they're not dead. They're like undead, sort of a shambling relic of what they used to be. And I'm talking about the National Front. I mean, I saw their national march to the cenotaph this year for Remembrance Day. Now, that used to be a march back in the National Front's heyday where thousands, if not tens of thousands, attended. There'd be a sea of flags. Everyone would be wearing suit shirts and ties. There would be numerous people there in military uniform, covered in medals. You know, the National Front was a household name, and at one point it was very respectable. I think this year there was about maybe high 20s, low 30s, and that's down from thousands. And you can see how an organization started off in such a good way, and then over time it attracted the wrong people. It was desperate to grow at any cost. It did anything it could for publicity, which involved marching, confrontation, and sure, it grabbed loads of headlines, but where is it today? Well, it's a shambling relic of what it was, because it did anything it could in its power to get publicity and to grow, but that growth wasn't controlled, it wasn't structured, and now it's one of these zombie parties. And that's quite sad. I mean, I remember when I first got involved in nationalism, I bought a copy of the best of William Pierce's National Vanguard paper. It's like a collection of his old writings. And one of them was about the National Front, talking about how it was the world's leading movement. It was smart. It was full of well-dressed people, people who were very articulate, who had a good standing in life. And you look at what it is today, and it's very sad to see these things collapse, but all of these movements have followed the same flawed template of growth at any cost.
Would you say that that was the reason why they fell apart? Just this sort of lack of concern for the long term. They're just thinking growth right now. Anyone will take anyone.
I think the National Front's collapse was actually very interesting, and it was largely due to the leadership at the time refusing to acknowledge when something that worked once was now failing to work. Now, initially, the National Front employed a tactic called march and grow. So they would go to, say, a city. Let's take Leicester, for example, which was the first city to become a place where white Britons were a minority. Now, they'd go to Leicester and several thousand people would turn out and march, and there'd be flags. Everyone would be at the front of the march, would be suit, shirt and tie. And it would be very good. And obviously that would make the papers. Normal people would come out and see the march. And after they'd marched through the town or the city, they'd get loads of inquiries. So it was march and grow. But pretty soon, the left realised that if they turned up at the march and started hurling bricks, started attacking the march, the police would get involved. So then you'd have the National Front marching, you'd have the police around the National Front, then you'd have the left in front of the other side of the police. So the public, to see the National Front, would have to get through the left, and they'd have to get through the police, and they'd also have to get through all the violence, the shouting, the trouble. And all of a sudden, march and grow was quite the opposite. It was sort of march and shrink. And the marches did shrink, and they shrank because normal people, the people in the suits, shirts and ties, the school teachers, the ex-military, the respectable people left because they didn't want to turn up at a march and get their heads kicked in. So all of a sudden it became this awful self-selecting situation where the only people left on the march were the people who wanted violence. So then you had two groups of people. You had nationalists, the skinheads, and the violent sort of hooligan types who wanted a good fight and were never going to back down. You had the police in the middle. Then you had the left who wanted a fight. And it just became a constant struggle. And the leadership at that point should have said, look, march and grow isn't working. We need to not retreat, but restructure what we do. So if we go out leafleting on an estate, no one can come and oppose us because we don't announce where we're going to be. You know, if we turn up and do a tabletop in a town centre and announce, no one knows where we're going to be. But they didn't do that. They said, it's our right to march. We'll carry on marching. And it was kind of like a 1930s tactic. They were expecting to do what a certain party did in another country in before the 1930s, which was eventually they smashed the opposition off the street and then they marched their heart's content without opposition. But that was never going to happen in 1970s Britain, and it didn't, and it failed. And I think some of these parties, they don't see that a tactic that works one day can sometimes be a tactic that actually harms you the next day. And then you have to change and evolve, just like everyone has to change and evolve as the political landscape changes.
And what other mistakes? I'm interested in how do you see Patriotic Alternative in light of all of these past movements? Is it going to be a political party?
Yes, it is going to be a political party, but and this is going to sound contradictory, but it's not going to be a political party that initially stands in general elections or stands in elections which cost lots of money. And people are going, well, what's the point then if you're not going to stand in the general election? Well, put it like this. The Brexit Party, which had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds, they stood 273 seats nationally. Now, I know that's not every seat in the UK. So when you take it as a percentage, it's not going to be reflective of the whole nation. But out of 273 seats across the whole nation and hundreds of thousands of pounds, a leader who is regularly invited on TV shows, is a celebrity, is a national name, they took 2% of the vote when the entire election was based around the issue of Brexit. Now, when you're talking about that much money, and for a decent, let me just calculate this, for a decent election address, the deposit, which is £500, and then some extra material, so a leaflet you put out by hand, posters, banners, etc., you're probably looking a minimum of £2,000 per seat. Now, they sank 273 seats, so that was £546,000 minimum is what the Brexit Party spent on that election. Now, for 2% of the vote, I think we can both agree that's probably not money well spent. In fact, that's pretty lousy return on investment. And I think what we need to do long, long before we go throwing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people's hard-earned money, because that's what it is. When people talk about money in political parties, people talk about money, but it's not just money. It's donations, and donations come out of people's pockets. So if you're going to say to hardworking people who are often on the breadline, give us your money for a project, and then you're going to sink that into a general election, and you go back to those people and say, well, thanks for giving us the best part of 600 grand, we got 2%. That's not a good return on people's investment. Now, if I had something like £500,000 to play with, we would be setting up a regional structure of paid organisers around the country who would hold local events, set up community forums, get things done that bring us together. Because the problem that we've got as people, yes, we don't have parliamentary seats, but at the moment, we don't even have community groups. And parliamentary seats flow from community groups. They flow from powerful organised communities that vote as blocks. And until we've got powerful organised communities that vote as blocks, there's no point just throwing good money after bad elections, basically. And I think you'll agree when I say this, but being a nationalist can be hard. It can be depressing. It can be isolating. But when you have a meeting, like our Christmas parties, where you come together and you sit in a room full of smiling, like-minded people who all share the same hopes and dreams, you all have the same fears and concerns, you feel as if you're not isolated or alone anymore. And I don't think we can underestimate the power of community meetings, of places where we can go and talk about what we want to talk about, where we can express ourselves. And that's what I'm most eager to build, a place that we can call home.
So would you say that Patriotic Alternative is a political party in the future, or in the making, but for now it's a community building organization, operation?
Yes, I mean, if people want to stand in local elections, that's great, and I would certainly assist them. And if something came up, let's say there was a parliamentary by-election where there was a hideously unpopular Labour MP in a Leave area who kept telling the people that, you know, they had to vote Remain, and we could go there and get 10% and catapult ourselves into the public eye very easily, then brilliant. But at the moment, the first and foremost, we need a national structure, we need community groups, and we need to build, well, local functioning units where people can meet regularly. And it doesn't sound particularly revolutionary to say meet and sort of be friends and have fun together.
But it is, though, in this context, because we're operating in a context where we have been atomized, where everyone has been separated. It's been made a career suicide, social suicide, to ally with these ideas. So we do need to reconnect. That actually is the first step.
Exactly. The first conference we held in Manchester, I remember, when we all left, I got home that day and I was checking my phone, and obviously I'd got a lot of messages from people who'd been at the meeting. And I continued to receive these messages, you know, well into the next week. And the overwhelming feeling from people who'd attended was that they had such a great time that when they left, they didn't want to leave. They didn't want it to end. They wanted sort of a second day of conference, and they wanted to do the conference again the next weekend. Because for people just to be able to sit around a dinner table, dress nicely, with other people dressed nicely, having polite conversations about the things that bounce around in their heads day in, day out, but they can't tell people. They can't tell the normies down the pub. They can't tell their work colleagues. They can't, some of them can't even tell their families.
Yeah, but people are self-censoring all the time, even with their edgy lefty friends. You know, even they, the stuff that they cannot see.
Exactly. And I think it becomes very oppressive. It becomes very depressing. It becomes almost sort of almost too much for some people, almost too much for some people. And people do slip into a type of depression. And I speak to many young men who are in that place. You know, they don't like to go out. They don't like to speak to people. They feel they can't relate because they feel there's sort of this itch that they can't scratch. They know everything around them is wrong. And they just want to sit down with people who also feel that way, and they can be themselves. They can make friends. And it is very isolating. And the problem with the online community is the online community, it can be very nasty. It can be a place where people come, people go, no one really connects properly. And people are so quick to fly off the handle because everyone's just avatars speaking to avatars. But real world meetings are just so much more gratifying for everyone who's there. They're so much more enjoyable.
Oh, yeah. I think that, when you remember social occasions, you don't remember online social occasions. I don't know, maybe I shouldn't speak too quickly, because perhaps in the future people will look fondly back at millennial episodes and so on. But I think that most of the time, social occasions that you recall are ones from real life where you were actually with people. And now I think that there's a lot to be said. I mean, what I would like to see in the next decade, in this coming decade, is the emergence of social cultural scenes around the country. But especially, the obvious one would be London, because that's where this stuff tends to happen. That's where big cities have always been for, is for cultural movements to grow and new ideas to flourish, because you've got a concentration of lots of creative and talented people in one place. And that's what I'd like to see, because that's something I feel I would be at home with. But that's not the only kind of IRL events that are needed because most people will not be at home with something like that. They want, the kind of thing that you're doing with PA.
Well, it can be both. There's no reason why people...
I know.
You know, can't hold that in the name of patriotic alternative. London is not a place for me. I don't like London. I find London somewhere that's very oppressive. I find it sort of stressful. It's too busy. There's too many people. I find it sort of drains away my soul when I'm there. It's just horrible. I'm more of I don't mind going into cities, but London, there's just something horrible about it. Even just traveling on the tube. I'd rather be out in the countryside having a walk on a Sunday morning and, just being in the green space. But if people in London are ready to organise and they're ready to have cultural meetings, it's time to do it. And if people can fight back in an area like that, all the more power to them, because doing that in a place where white Britons are already a minority makes it so much harder, because London's kind of one of those self-selecting places, isn't it? The vast majority of people who feel the way we do have left London. They lived in the old East End. They put up a bit of a fight. When that went down, they moved to Essex. And when Essex goes down, they'll move further north and further north. That's generally what people do.
Oh, yeah. What I'm interested in is the people who live in the West End of London. What are they going to do? How long are they going to live? Areas like Richmond, Teddington, these nice parts of London are still quite native. And I'm interested in how long that's going to last. I actually lived in Richmond a long time, like 15 years ago. And I remember feeling it was like even more so now, but even back then it was like an oasis. And I wonder, because it's actually a large area of land, and I'm wondering how long can that world go on for? given that just on its doorstep is, you know, multicultural London. But I am interested because that's, I think all of this, every part of this, every city, every town, every village, every part of each city is something that we can either lose or have lost. And I think that we should be, you know, it's all valuable. You know, people in the chat are saying that London's a shithole. That's a very simplistic thing to say. Everyone always says that London is a cesspit. Yeah, I take the point, but I think that this is our capital city that we're talking about here. You know, are we just going to say abandon the capital city where everything happens? And I know I shouldn't say that. That sounds snobby. Of course, not everything happens in London, but it is the heart of cultural activity. So I think that we should be looking to, you know, put our flagpole in there.
Well, I'm going to answer that in two ways. Firstly, you've got yourself a job there, Colin. I'm now appointing you as a London organiser. You've got to win it back. You've got to win it back, Colin. And that's there's a certain degree of humour in that, but also there's a certain degree of truth. I mean, if you feel passionately about winning back London, you know, that is what you must do. But when we talk about culture, and this isn't something that I was going to speak about just yet, but there's a place in Lincolnshire, a little village. It's called Heckington. And every year they hold a show there called the Heckington Show. And it's the largest and oldest village show in the whole of the country. And as you can imagine, it's sort of 99.9% recurring white. It's the kind of place. And it has very much sort of a villagey feel to it. You know, there's a tractor show. People grow vegetables and exhibit them. Children make miniature gardens and they're all on show and they're judged. You know, people show off their farm animals. You know, there's auctions for, you know, ducklings and sheep. Now, this might sound very not London, but you should go up to Heckington Show and you should go to a place like that and you should be around. You know, there's cheese stalls, there's all local butchers, local meats.
Nothing against this at all. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm against the rural, like I'm a rootless metropolitan. It sounds lovely, and I think it's great. I won't name it, but I went to a thing recently, about 2 months ago now, in rural England. And it was a sort of get-together festival thing. And it was great. And it was massively native. I mean, I was staggered by just how low participation there was from, our new friends, let's say.
Well, what I was thinking is, you know, we could all go to a place like that, to one of these shows. And when you're there, and you're surrounded by genuine, because one thing that I really hate, this is a bit of a personal bugbear of mine, and this is what the left always do. You know, when we say, look, we want to retain our culture, we want to retain our heritage, our traditions, etc. There's always some sort of leftist snob who turns their nose up and is like, the British don't have culture. You know, the migrants come here and they bring the culture. What's our culture? A bag of soggy chips, you know, and you feel yourself boiling up inside. And, you know, I'm not going to say what it makes you want to do to these people. But the fact is, you go to something like the Heckington Show and that is genuine British culture. Now, you compare that show, the largest village show in the country, with the Notting Hill Carnival. Now, I bet the BBC nationally would never cover the Heckington Show because it's indigenous, it's homogenous, it's crime-free, it's a lovely family. I'll be taking my daughter there next year, okay? Now, compare that with the Notting Hill Carnival, which is like a, you know, a drug-fueled...
It's a proper festival. It's got loads of crime.
It's a drug-fueled stab fest, isn't it? You know, it's like if you were taking your family to the Notting Hill Carnival, you'd want to spend thousands beforehand on, like, you know, we need some stab vest, we need, you know, make sure we've got the swabs and other medical equipment just in case. It's like, it's awful. And that's the thing, though, isn't it? And the BBC are raving over, they're like, Notting Hill Carnival, the best, yeah. And there's some sort of white female police officer pinned up against railings as sort of 10 black males twerk around her, and she just looks really scared, and all the officers, well, we cannot move in and arrest anyone. This is blatantly like sexual harassment of the worst kind. But if anyone gets arrested, it's going to be like Stabathon 2020. You know what I mean? It's the riots last 3 or 4 days. And that's Notting Hill Carnival. And you compare that with something like the Heckington Show, and it's night and day with what our people create and what other people create. And I think we need to start attending these healthy events, and we need to start creating this.
More. I absolutely. I think we should be, it doesn't, that's the thing, right? It doesn't need to, this is an important point to make. It doesn't need to be something explicitly nationalist. Right? That's a sort of autistic thing that some people sometimes come up with, that we can just go to our own things, the stuff that is traditionally ours. That's as important, I think.
Well, you're right. And this is another thing where nationalism has failed in the past. You see, groups like the National Front, I remember when one person was in charge of the National Front, their idea of sort of making a new culture or making a counterculture was they got a lot of skinhead bands involved. They started a record label called White Noise. And is that really going to appeal to the majority of people? It's kind of a navel-gazing experiment, really. It's not going to, you know, the masses are not going to flock to that. But what you've just said would be 100 or 1,000 times more effective. All just go to your local village show as a group and start to become the local village show. You know, there are existing structures still there that we can take over. I mean, I know this is sort of like flipping the topic from, you know, local village show, but if 10 of you live in an area and you're all Christian, we'll all start attending the same church. And before you know where you are, you're running the local parish church as a nationalist group. You know, you don't have to try and create everything from scratch. You can go to existing institutions or events and take them over and co-opt them.
Well, I mean, I wasn't alluding to actually co-opting things. I was just saying preserving them by taking part in them, stuff that is not. Because that's the thing. I don't think that everything should be about nationalism. Not all, you know, everything should be about ideology or whatever. That's a very, I don't think that's very British, to be honest. And maybe I'm naive. Maybe I'm Sargon-esque saying that, but I hope not. But I think that there needs to be a place for just, you know, enjoying things, our things, you know, that they are implicitly our things. I mean, as I said, this festival thing that I went to 2 months ago, it was just, it was as if there were signs on all of the roads leading into this town, only natives welcome, you know? It might as well have been that. It repelled them. It repelled our, I don't know how to say this, new Britons. It repelled them by being British, unashamedly. They didn't want to take part in it. It's got nothing to do with them. Because this is the kind of thing where the BBC will say, it's terrible. It's terrible that this festival is not diverse enough. That's something we've definitely got to fight back against, because that's how they take these things from us. Because then that festival, the organisers feel compelled to make it more diverse, and that kills it. So that's something we've definitely got to go. We have to preserve these things that are ours, because they are sources of strength. They're not explicitly ideological or political, but they are deep. They're spiritual. And I think that they're very, very important to us, and we should got to take steps to look after them.
Yeah, I agree. And it's kind of funny what you said there, because you said, like, we don't have to go there and politicize them. We don't have to go and make them political, because by doing that, you know, not everything just has to be ideological. But it's kind of funny you say that, because these events, we don't really have to make them ideological, because they are almost the fruit of our ideology. If we were in power, if you and I were running the country now, and we were sort of, you know, Prime Minister and Home Secretary, these events would be what would flow from that. And that's the interesting thing.
Absolutely. It is. Keep going, please.
No, basically, you know, if we were to put in place policies for the enrichment of our people, the betterment of our people, the kind of policies that would bring people together where we could express who we really were, those policies would express themselves in events like these village shows, like these country shows. They wouldn't express themselves in kind of, you know, perverse modern art. They wouldn't express themselves in sort of rowdy marches through the streets where everyone's got a can of beer in their hand and they powdered their nose on the megabus on the way down to London. They wouldn't express themselves in sort of like the Notting Hill Stab Fest. They would express themselves in cultural events which were high IQ, high trust. And this is another thing about these kind of events. I remember my parents taking me there as a child, because the reason I know about this show is because my parents grew up in that village. So they would go and visit their mum and dad, my grandparents, and they would take me, and I always go as a child. And one thing I remember is, even though I was very young when I went to the Heckington show with my cousins, I think I was maybe sort of 6, 7, there was no sort of fear of letting myself and my cousins go off on our bikes and sort of, or walk around this event on your own. Whereas had you been in a big city, there would have been that fear. And that, again, is a massive expression of the kind of high trust, high IQ, peaceful, homogenous sort of ethnocentric society we want to build. It would be a place where parents wouldn't think twice to say to their kids, well, if you want to go and have a look at the ducklings over there, you go off there and here's a pound each to get an ice cream. Now, you would never do that with your children in London, would you?
No, sadly not. Indeed, I mean, it's a big thing nowadays where people will share around a clip of London from yesteryear, the 40s, the 50s, 60s, or even the 70s. And it's a lost world. It's really depressing, actually.
It's funny because you say it's depressing. There's a guy in the chat. I've got one eye on the chat, and somebody's just said a guy called, I can't actually pronounce this, Marcus 10. He said, no fear. Imagine that today. And that's a very important statement. You know, there's people make these statements, and that's very profound, really, because we live in a society where fear is normal. And that is insane. I mean, it's only sort of 4 or 5 decades ago when people wouldn't even think about locking their front door unless they went away on holiday. It's only sort of, you know, a few decades ago where children would routinely play in the street, where they would, you know, they'd leave in the morning with their friends on their bikes, and, you know, they wouldn't obviously have mobile phones, and then their parents would just trust they would be home for tea in the evening. And all of these things that we took for granted have now been replaced. And what have they been replaced with? They've been replaced with fear. And we now take fear for granted as the new norm. And that just shows how far we as a people have fallen, that we actually normalize and rationalize living in fear as an acceptable payoff for, you know, tons of people who really shouldn't even be here.
Yeah. Another thing that I noticed recently is another change is, you used to hear people say, just as a casual thing, like a sort of joke almost, but it was real, and they could say it because it was true. They would say, why not? It's a free country. No one says that now. I honestly can't remember the last time I heard someone say, it's a free country. It was just like something that people used to say. Like, you see, you hear it all the time. And it made me realize, you know, on the one hand, yes, there's an excess of license and, you know, breakdown of conventions, whatever. But at the same time, there's been a real curtailment of the people's awareness, like people's feeling of being free. On the one hand, they know they're free to do this and that, take drugs, have sex, or whatever. But the feeling of general freedom has actually gone, because I think people increasingly feel that they're not free. They're constantly being watched. They're being monitored. And, you know, obviously, I don't need to list these stories of someone getting a visit from the police because of something they've said online, and not even breaking the law. They've just said something that drew the attention of Prevent or whatever. And I think in general, people, native Brits, don't feel that it would be an appropriate thing to say it's a free country anymore.
No, and that is very telling, actually. And it's, when you were saying that, I was laughing, because I remember, I mean, obviously, I'm sort of 39, and I remember when I was sort of much younger, that would be sort of a rallying cry from anyone who was told that they couldn't do something that they believed they should be able to do. You know, when we were sort of much, much younger, you know, it was something that was sort of shouted at people, wasn't it? If somebody said, oh, you can't do that. You can't walk down there. You don't want to be going out at that time of night. Somebody'd be like, it's a free country. I'll do as I please. And yeah. You just don't hear that anymore. You know, in fact, you hear the opposite, don't you? People are like, oh, you better not say that. Better not do that. You know, it's the exact opposite.
Exactly. Are you serious? You're going to do that? Etc. Yeah. Whereas I can remember people saying, why am I going to do this? It's a free country. That's why I'm going to do it. Because I can. And I think this, I mean, it's a silly kind of thing. It's a trite phrase. But people could say it because it was true. That's the thing. It's no longer true. There is no longer this sense that we can basically suit ourselves, not do outrageous things, not like, you know, vomit in the gutter and whatever, and you know, break windows or whatever. But just the sense of that this is our homeland and we can be relaxed here. That feeling, I think, has rapidly disappeared. It's one of those things where it's easy to forget. It's easy to lose track of change because it happens at just the right speed that you don't notice it. And you know, if you look back, Britain in the mid-90s, Europe in the mid-90s, but let's keep it on Britain, basically it was a white country, you know. And the TV was accurate, you know, in the way it depicted that. If anything, it over depicted the minorities, as it certainly does now. But no, it was the country that we grew up in and had known and our parents had known. And so the change in Britain and Europe more widely, the drastic change has really occurred since the mid-90s, I would say. Of course, in the British context, you can blame New Labour for that, at least for starting it.
And it's also really funny, like something that just came into my head when you said it's a free country and people don't say that anymore. I have lots of normie friends on Facebook, and I quite like looking at what the normies say, because not only do they not say it's a free country, I've seen so many, not political people, but normal folk, begin Facebook posts with, I'm probably going to get into trouble for saying this, or, you know, and they know.
Yes. This is probably going to cost me socially and maybe even professionally. Yeah, exactly. That is now the thing. That has replaced the general assumption of freedom and whatever, being able to be candid, has been replaced by a general assumption of, I could suffer if I do this, if I say this thing, or if I do that thing, or even the way in which I say this thing. You know, people are hyper aware now. I mean, political correctness has gone from something you heard about on TV or whatever to a general fact of life, and it is not a pleasant for most people. It's at best it's a bummer, it's an annoyance, and for worse it's changing the tone of your entire daily being.
No, it is. And you see normal people self-censor at all times. And I don't go out of my way to be controversial, but sometimes if I sense I'm around people who might want somebody to be more straight talking, I sometimes just blurt out what might be on my mind. If I hear people skirting around issues, I just blurt out what's on my mind. And sometimes you get people sort of like give you a little giggle. Oh, you can't say that, and giggle. I mean, that's telling enough to say you can't say that. But you almost, from a lot of people, when you actually blurt out sort of one of these home truths, the sort of thing people would freely say sort of a decade ago or a couple of decades ago, all of a sudden it's like there's so much relief in the room. And people who were previously sort of so uptight and not speaking just spill forth everything that's in their head because they're bottling it all up. You've got people walking around with all these feelings, with all these sort of hopes and dreams and desires and all these things they want to say about the current political system, but none of them feel as if they're able to say it. And as soon as you sort of say, it's okay, mate, it's okay, let it all out, it's almost like you're taking normies through some kind of social therapy. And once they start letting it all out, they won't stop speaking. And I really discovered this. I've spoken about this with you before, but when we used to do the Brexit stalls, people would come and go, yeah, that European Union's a bit annoying, isn't it? And you'd be like, yep. And they'd be like, well, do you know what really annoys me? And there's just like, no one's listening. You're like, there's a few too many immigrants, isn't it? I mean, just, you know, we just, it's a matter of space. And you'd be like, yep. And then they'd be like, but it's a bit more, isn't it? It's some of them, they're just not like us, are they? And you'd be like, yeah, they're not. And then all of a sudden, once they saw it was okay to speak, everyone would then pour forth with their own personal story of why mass migration and multiculturalism was ruining their life in some way. And I think when you've got that and in your country, you can see the time is now ripe for a sensible nationalist party, because everyone's got their own tale of why they hate living in modern contemporary Britain. And when they open the papers every morning, you can see people are there in their tent. They're waiting, aren't they? They're waiting to see Stormzy on page 4 telling them how they're some sort of racist animal because, you know, they're like fish and chips on a Friday night or something. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that is a, and that's a, actually, I mean, it's funny, but it's a really bad way for people to be. I mean, it's a bad situation where people are now expecting to be attacked for basically being white, really, and for having white culture, for native British culture. And it's very bad for it to be at this stage now where it's just expected. I think that's, I mean, yeah, we can laugh about the absurdity of it, but it's essential that we fight back against it.
And you've just got to say, haven't we? I mean, I never swear. I don't think this is really a swear word, but Stormzy is a real dickhead, isn't he? I mean, he is an absolute, yeah, he's just reprehensible. And it's so funny because he's such a low IQ, sort of like, you know, pea brain. And he spits forth this nonsense. And the way people act is if he's just come out with some intellectual pearl of wisdom, sort of unmatched, as if move over Plato, Stormzy's he's rapping, you know.
It's embarrassing to see these middle-class leftists embracing him and following what he says. I mean, they do this with the most ridiculous, like Harry Potter is this general source of quotations for a lot of people on Twitter, the lefties. It's just ridiculous. I can see you.
I love it. I love the way that the left can't rationalize anything in their lives unless they do it set to kind of the template of Harry Potter. So it's like, you know, when they didn't allow me to go into the female bathroom, I was curled up in a ball crying, but then I realised it was like when Harry Potter couldn't get through the gate to meet Voldemort. And you sat there thinking, what is this? You can't analyse your entire life through like these awful children's books, which are the most beta things ever. And this is something I really hate. Like, when we were kids, we had like the Transformers. These were like huge, hulking, transforming robots. And in the movie, like, you know, stuff got real. You know, Megatron executed Optimus Prime within the first 15 minutes of the 1986 movie. You know, we had He-Man, this guy who was basically like the golden one in cartoon form. You know, you had the A-Team. You know, they used to go around in their van machine gunning people. And now you've got this stupid little twerp on a broomstick. And every leftist is, you know, wetting their knickers with excitement of how they can rationalize how they are the Harry Potter of wherever they're working or whatever they do. They're the Harry Potter of, you know, the Burger King fry shaker people. It's just, it's so sad. Yeah,
it's insane. And I do remember, it's sometimes amazing to look back at those, like He-Man and these other things and see just how, that's a completely different topic. But see, like masculinity was not derided at all in the 80s. I mean, it's one of these things that you only realise when you look back, when you actually review what was going on 30 years, because that is 30 years ago, or nearly 40 years ago, in fact. What was going on then? What was the norm then? And, you know, it was normal for women to look up to men. It was normal for men to have a hierarchy. It was normal for men to aspire to masculinity. It was normal for women to aspire to femininity. That's what it was actually like to live in a relatively sane society. And of course, the role models that they saw on TV as kids, encouraged this. They encouraged this way of looking at the world and this way of relating to other people. Now, I just cannot imagine how confusing it must be to be a child now, to grow up in Britain in the last, you know, to be a 10-year-old now. I don't know what to say.
No, I think it'd be pretty damn awful, actually. I think if you were a child today, it would be so directionless. There'd be, I don't know. And everything today, I know people look at things through rose-tinted spectacles, but there was a real charm to the way things were. And I think everything that there was some charm to, the sort of the system that we live in sucks the life out of it. And just a little example of what we were talking about with the 80s, the original Transformers. I see people in the chat and people are naming their favorite Transformers. Do you know what? People will always be fond of like Optimus Prime and Megatron and Shockwave and Soundwave and Devastator as they were in the 80s and Starscream, you know, Bumblebee. But when you look at the mess that Michael Bay made of it, these kind of like, it was just a mess. It was a mess that they threw money at and it became soulless. And I think even the things that had some spirit and some soul in the 80s and 90s, the modern system sucks the life out of that. And it just turns everything into sort of a retread and a rehash, but a soulless retread and rehash. And this isn't just about 80s toys. This isn't just about, you know, the things that we watched as kids. It's everything. And it all gets recycled. And it's not only do they suck the soul out of it, but what do they create now that's new, that's actually good? You know, you go to the cinema, everything's a reboot, a remake, a rehash, a retelling. And 9 times out of 10, that rehash, that retelling isn't as good as it was before. It's like our enemies. Not only are they useless at redoing what we once had, but they have no fresh ideas of their own at all, do they?
I think part of the problem for them is that any new idea, everything is so, how you've got to avoid being offensive. So what can you do? All you can really do is another iteration of the lesson that men and women are the same. And that nothing actually, like, nothing matters, that there's nothing, that there's no structure, there are no categories, there are no boundaries. That's how it is. And what can you depict? I mean, what are the conflicts between the characters? What kind of characters can you have on screen? Because they all have to represent something. So, but increasingly it's very difficult because you're, in the real world, we're supposed to believe that even cultures don't really matter. Races don't really matter. Religions don't really, nothing really matters. Male and female doesn't matter. So for a storyteller, this is a terrible challenge because what can you say that doesn't violate that? In any story, something has to matter. So I guess what they do, what they go for is freedom matters, equality matters, and that's it. Well, that's going to be a very boring story, and it's going to be the same story time after time after time after time.
I also love as well how, and then this goes back to the 80s, like, you knew that the vast majority of boys were not going to grow up to be He-Man. And because He-Man was what he was, you knew to achieve his feats would take an awful lot of work. He'd have to be very strong and very powerful. But in more modern, in all sort of modern sort of media, they always ascribe these great powers to people who wouldn't really have them. So there's like some dumpy little, you know, Oompa Loompa female who's, you know, high kicking men and knocking out guys twice their size. And you saw this with the latest Charlie's Angel film that completely failed, you know, because these girls obviously weren't going to overpower big beefy men. It's impossible. But the problem is, whereas we knew that we weren't He-Man as children, because he was big and he was beefy and he was tough and he was, you know, almost the unattainable male. the problem you've got now is they're showing people doing things that are sort of regular people because they're trying to empower all the dorks and the leftists and the weasels and the freaks. And the problem with this is it gives people ideas above their station and it translates into the real world. So the other day I was driving along and I saw these two PCSOs. Now, these are those police officers that aren't real police officers. And one was this fat guy and he was a proper state. And the other one walking with him was an even fatter woman. I mean, I don't even know how they got military trousers in her size. I mean, since when do they make military trousers with a front gunt pocket? It was just hideous. And the funny thing, I was driving along just laughing at them because I was just thinking, if you do come across some naughty kids, which one of you's giving chase? The answer being neither.
Yeah, it is a weird thing. Another aspect of all this, just to get back to the issue of what people see on TV and in films, is that I'm convinced it's not satisfying for people. You know, when it's a girl in this ridiculous, what's it called? I forgot. You mentioned it just now, the Hollywood film, Charlie's Angels.
That's it.
How many girls actually want to be like that compared to how many girls want to be rescued? I mean, which is more deeply satisfying? The notion of being this tough bitch who can take down the bad guys and the notion of being vulnerable and rescued by a guy. I think for most women, it's the latter. That's built into them that they want that, I think. I mean, I don't know. Is that sexist of me? Is that misogynistic of me?
No, but it's true. Which is attainable? Which is attainable? Is it attainable to be the princess who looks feminine, acts in a feminine manner, and is rescued by a powerful, dashing male? Or is it attainable to be one of Charlie's Angels, backflipping and, you know, karate kicking men two or three times your weight? No, that's impossible. It's ridiculous. And, you know, again, but it feeds into the sort of nonsense of the modern world. Like, you know, trans athletes is another sort of expression of the madness of the modern world that all ties in with this. Be anything you want, anything goes. We're all equal, we're all the same. You can be your own superhero. It's just so ridiculous and it makes your head hurt. But the funny thing about it is all of that would have been a comedy sketch. I remember when there was that fight in some park in London between trans exclusionary feminists and trans women, and they were fighting over who were the real women. That would have been a sketch show. That would have been a sketch show on a comedy sort of 20 years ago, and everyone would be rolling around the floor laughing. And now it's actually really taking place in a park near you.
Sorry, lost the tab. It's absolutely crazy. And I often wonder, you know, because I've seen episodes of The Two Ronnies. People always mention Monty Python. They always like, it's surreal. It's like a Monty Python. It's true. But also, even The Two Ronnies were doing this kind of thing. They had a sketch, a long-running sketch about The Worm Has Turned or something like that. And it's funny. But you know, I hate, it's such an obvious thing to say. It was funny then because it seemed preposterous. It's now we're kind of heading into this situation where it is almost reality.
Was that the one where women took power and started persecuting men for sort of looking at them in a sexual way or anything?
Yeah.
And the men were running a resistance group and they finally escaped because they released a mouse into the room and all the women who were sort of coming to arrest them ran off screaming because the mouse chased them. And it kind of, the final punchline was, no matter what you, how you empower these women at their hearts, they're still women and they'll still, you know, run squawking when like a mouse is released into the room.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that.
Yeah. I think that is the one. This is a thing, you know, people are still people. And I honestly think that for all of the social conditioning, it can actually be undone relatively easily. And indeed, I mean, as long as they haven't gone on the hormone replacement therapy and so on, it's something that a lot of them could grow out of. A few years ago, there was the very famous dye cis scum girl. I don't know if you saw that. There was a photo released of her maybe last year. She's normal now.
And she's attractive, isn't she?
Yeah, she's quite homely.
Yeah, she threw off the sort of madness, grew her hair back. And I remember when that photo came out and she was like, yeah, I've sort of transitioned into normality. And the left went crazy, didn't it? The amount of hate this girl got for sort of growing her hair back, because she had a shaved head, didn't she? You know, she grew her hair, you know, she grew her hair back. She took off the sort of ridiculous makeup, removed like the piercings and just stood there in a nice dress, and she looked beautiful. You could see how much happier she was, how less sort of pent up she was. And the left went mad. And when you see the left doing that, you can actually see how much these people hate beauty and normalcy and tradition and sort of, you know, just the heterosexual normality. Because when they see a beautiful heterosexual woman wanting to embrace her natural role in life, they absolutely flip out.
Well, it's a failure of their program, isn't it? It's not, that's not what they ever want. They never want that. They never want nature to be running its course and men and women to be getting together and having kids and so on. They want as many exceptions to that as possible, even if the most bizarre. Like, I mean, I still don't know what non-binary, gender fluid, what these terms even mean. I think that it's just an endless diversity of, well, I should be careful what I say. but you can imagine what I think of this. It's just insanity. It used to be there was male, female, and then a very small number of in-between, like anomalies. That was it. And that was enough. You know, we understood that the anomalies are, it's an unfortunate thing that happens sometimes. And of course, same with sexuality. Vast majority of people are heterosexual, a few homosexual, a few bisexual, but vast majority are heterosexual, and anything else is something's gone wrong somewhere, whether it's genetics, hormones, we don't know, life experiences, doesn't matter. That was it. And it was, that's, I mean, really, I think what is so strange now is that we're not just supposed to accept it, the anomalies, we're supposed to all assume that basically everyone is an anomaly. That's, there is no normalcy at all anymore. I think, and of course, I'm not saying anything revelatory here. I'm just noting how profoundly unnatural a situation we now live in.
No, it's funny when you put it in such simple terms. It really does shine a light on it, doesn't it? And you see how insane it is. And as you say, you know, you might have a million people and sort of roughly 500 or sort of 499,998 are women, the same amount of men. And somewhere in between, there's four bizarre anomalies, four people who were born with kind of indeterminate genders or, you know, have severe mental illnesses. But for those vast, vast majority of people, for the nearly 1 million people who are normal men or women, their entire lives are being legislated on the basis of the four complete anomalies. And we are basically legislating for the whole of society on these tiny, tiny minorities. And then those minorities are amplified to a ridiculous point. I mean, the amount of talk of transgender in the news at the moment.
I've said this in several hangouts already this millennial. It's every single day. I mean, it used to be something that you heard of every few months, that this would enter your life in some way. Someone would say something, or, you know, it's all the time now. Sorry, go on.
No, it is. I was actually looking for, I was looking in my folder of previous sort of videos that I've done, because I actually did a video about how the right-wing press sort of normalized, and I broke this down. I thought it was quite good at the time. I broke it down into sort of a four-stage process of how the right-wing press actually normalize these entirely insane things. So you'll have a paper like the Daily Mail, and its first stage will be shock horror, you know, the transgenders. So it'll introduce the transgender issue. That's the first stage. The second stage is it overdoes it. So it oversaturates you with so much transgender stuff that by the end of it, you stop being outraged. So normal people are no longer outraged. At first they were, but now they've seen so much of it, like, oh God, not another transgender story. And they start to, you know, just turn over the page, they don't even read the stories anymore because they're normalized, habituated to it. Phase three then is they pick someone to be persecuted. So now people are bored of reading about the transgender story. So the third stage is people are being persecuted for being transgender. So normal people are like, oh, well, you know, at first I was a bit shocked, but then I got bored of it. And I suppose this is a bit mean to call them names. And then finally, stage four is the complete normalization, where they pick somebody who then becomes a hero for that group. And that hero is then held up as a sort of a better person than the rest of us. And that person, in the transgender case, would be Bruce Jenner. So, you know, first it's shock horror, then it's like drip, drip, drip. Every week you hear about it. Then finally, oh, these people are being persecuted. You shouldn't be a bigot. And then here's our hero. They're actually better than us. And this is what the right-wing press do. It's a very careful game of normalizing horrific things. And I think they're pushing it so much now. I mean, I bet if we both went out tomorrow and knocked on 1,000 doors, we wouldn't meet a single person who was transgender. But the way the Daily Mail talks about it is if every other person is just getting ready to go on hormone therapy and transition.
Yeah, exactly. You would think it was something that every person encountered every single day. When most people, I mean, I don't know, if you live in a big city, you might see it once a day, but probably not even that. And as for everyone who's not living in cities, which is the majority of people, I don't know how often they'll encounter someone in real life. I know, once a year. Yeah, it's incredible how much this is being pushed. I mean, none of this is surprising. None of this is going to surprise anyone. It's just interesting to sometimes note how far we've gone. Now, someone's just mentioned Bangkok ladyboys woes. Because I mentioned in a few, one of the first millennials this year, that in the early 2000s, I was taken by some friends of mine to a show of the ladyboys of Bangkok. And the thing is, back then, it was just a joke. It was just something. I know it's funny saying this, because it sounds like, oh, everyone was doing it. I was just following orders. But it was just everyone, like, I think it was a stag party or something. And it was just, that was how we understood it. It was something, for want of a better word, freakish. Otherwise, there would be no point going to this thing. The whole point was that it was a novelty and that it was kind of strange. It was like, I wouldn't liken it to other stuff. And so that was the whole point. Now, we're supposed to believe that basically every second person is like that, which is just crazy.
No, I agree. And things that were presented, and this is the important thing, when people, and I know that the left always do this, so we'll say something like, well, look, Drag Queen Story Hour is absolutely disgusting. It's foul. Children shouldn't be exposed to this degenerate filth. You're obviously trying to mix them up. And you look at some of the stuff these drag queens are wearing, they look satanic. They look demonic. It's clearly done in a way that would horrify and scare most children, give them nightmares. Now, the interesting thing about that is the left will say, but what about pantomimes? The pantomime dame was always a man dressed as a woman, but it wasn't done in the same way.
He was a pantomime dame. He wasn't something in real life.
But that was different, because that was a sort of a man putting on an over-exaggerated sort of, how can you say it? Like, you know, he was always dressed as kind of a buxom, sort of large bottomed, you know, gobby woman who would naturally be held up to ridicule and henpeck a man. And it was all done in a very sort of comedic way. And the children knew it was a man dressed as a woman.
And they were supposed to laugh at it.
Exactly.
That's the whole thing. You know, are you supposed to laugh at Drag Queen Story Hour when this demonic guy with the horns and ridiculous makeup and so on, and a beard, when he's, are you supposed to laugh? you know, I know you're supposed to be respectful and take it all extremely seriously, because it's not a joke. It's not something safe. It's something real, which, of course, I think to a five-year-old must be terrifying.
Exactly. And these people are not doing it to create sort of an amusing mockery of kind of a particular stereotype of a pushy, sort of overweight, overbearing woman who wears too much makeup and shrieks at like henpecked men. The people there, the drag queens, are meant to be taken 100% seriously as a legitimate expression of who they are, as a sexual expression of who they are. And that's the other big thing. Pantomime dames were never sexual. It wasn't being done as a sexual kink. Drag queens, on the other hand, are a sexual kink. It is people doing it for some kind of warped sexual pleasure. So it's completely different. It's night and day. But it's amazing how the left will take something as harmless and as silly as the pantomime dame and try to sort of equate it to drag queen story hour.
I've seen this a lot. I remember in 2012 or 13, I wrote a list of tricks that the left use in debate. And one of them is this, not that example, but this technique where it's a false equivalency between two things. It's simply not the same. Another would be when they say, well, okay, you think that gay couples shouldn't be allowed to adopt kids, but, you know, there are some bad heterosexual parents. As if that, exactly, it doesn't win the argument, but they think it does. And it's absurd. It's amazing how much of this, I mean, it's, you'll have encountered it yourself. I know that Laura has. There was actually someone did a sort of checkerboard of common lefty things they say in debate and about against us. One of them was, "Well, have you had your DNA checked? you might be in for some surprises." They think they're being original when they say that. Things like that. You've heard it 1,000 times. So go on.
Yeah, they've always got something. It's like, you know, there'd be a complete madman stood at a harbour somewhere, getting his family, you know, and all his worldly possessions, trying to get them into a dinghy. And you say, "What are you doing, mate?" And he's like, "Oh, I'm going to sail across the Atlantic to America." You're like, "In a dinghy, mate? Are you an idiot? It's obviously, you're not going to make it. You're obviously going to crash. You need to get on a proper sized cruise ship." Well, the Titanic sank, didn't it? Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So that means we should all go in a dinghy instead. And that is their sort of entire analogy for society. Oh, well, this one heterosexual couple weren't the best parents in the world. Thus, it would be much better if we gave all children to homosexuals. And you're like,
that's like one. This is the whole thing about the exception not disproving the rule. I mean, I only have to say the name Thomas Sowell, and you'll know what I'm alluding to. You know, they think one example, and that's your whole argument done. Another thing they'll say, it's actually, I'm looking through my meme folder to see if I can find this checkerboard thing that I mentioned, and I've just come across this one where they'll say, "Foreign people who don't belong in your country commit crimes." You know, I bet people who do belong in your country commit crimes too.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. I love that. It's like, well, because a small number of white people commit crimes, we must import people to the country who will also commit crimes, but at a greater rate. It's like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Because some white people rape women, we must import these other people who also rape women, just at a greater rate. Oh, wow. Sorry, I missed that stunning, brave logic.
Yeah, yeah. I have found one checkerboard, and it's similar, it's related. So I'll have a look at this. No, it's not the one. Sorry, no, not good enough. That's a shame, because it would have been fun to go through them, these common, ridiculous things that they say. Because I know that, you know, you don't get into arguments on Twitter, but I know that a lot of people still do, so it would have been funny to go through them all. But anyway, so let's get back on track and talk about Patriotic Alternative, because it is the, would you say that's the main thing? I would say that's the main thing that you've done this year, and the thing that it's the thing that's going to go forward and be very significant.
Well, hopefully it will. I mean, that was the big thing, and getting people organised and actually pulling it together has been a lot of effort, you know, especially, you know, myself, Laura, there's other people who help as well. And I think where we've really done something, you know, big is in the growth we've seen since 2018. You know, we had like fledgling, you know, the fledgling camp with just 12 people there. Well, there was nearly 40 this year. You know, last year we had one Christmas meeting with 12 people in Leeds. You know, we went around the Christmas market. You know, we ate a bit of food. This year there was three meetings. The London and Leeds ones both had about 35 there, and the West Midlands ones had about 20. So, you know, you had three great events there. Then we did the We Were Never Asked. We started doing sensible activism, and for a long time I've been pushing back against this nonsensical activism of like, you know, let's all announce where we're going to go. We'll turn up mob-handed, we'll drink a slab of beer on the megabus on the way down, and we'll have a giant kickoff. And I've always said that's not the way to do things. And I think We Were Never Asked was not only an excellent example of how activism can take place in such a good, productive way, but I think it's also an example of how you don't need to crowdfund, you know, £40,000 to make a credible documentary. And that's another thing that I keep talking about, that you get these people who are given sort of positions of power, and all of a sudden they want 100 grand for this, they want 200 grand for that, you know, well, we need 500 grand for legal costs. And I think one thing that I'm also proud about is when people signed up for Patriotic Alternative, people thought the email system wasn't working, because they weren't getting daily email updates and begging letters. You know, they got a Christmas update saying, hey, I hope you all have a great Christmas, because that's, again, not what we're about. We do need money to run a successful movement. But I think a lot of people in nationalism today are genuinely sick about feeling that feeling you get when you sign up to a group, and after 2 months of being involved, all you've done is got, you know, one or two emails a week begging for cash. And I think that really puts people off.
Oh, of course, because, for obvious reasons. But at the same time, funding is necessary. I mean, this is something that I think that we can be too reluctant to ask for funding on things on the right, but partly because of that history, but also because we don't want to be regarded as shills, and that, because there are so many. Well, I won't go into it, but yeah, there are. Speaking of which, on a related note, what would you like to say anything about Tommy Robinson?
Well, the thing with Tommy Robinson, this is when it goes into a big rant, isn't it? Whenever I start, the thing with Tommy Robinson, I never attacked him. And that was the weird thing. We talked about him honestly. We said that, I always said that, you know, he brought it upon himself going to jail. But I also said he shouldn't have gone to jail. They were far too harsh on him. And Patriotic Weekly Review and, you know, its forerunner this week on the alt-right always defended Tommy Robinson. And if you go back and look at old episodes, I used to get a lot of rubbish in the chat, people saying, oh, you know, why do you keep, you know, call it, you're a shill. Why do you keep sticking up for Robinson? And I would always be like, look, he does more good than he does harm. He basically wakes a lot of normies up. He fights, you know, about the grooming issue, which is a major issue. We must never play down how large the grooming scandal is. But then out of nowhere, because I defeated some of his friends in a debate when I debated those four tribal members of the tribe, he released that documentary on that attack on me called How to Burn a Nazi, you know, literally inciting violence against me. Because,
that's when he was in prison, though, wasn't it? So it wasn't him, it was his hand.
It was, but he didn't take it down when he got out, did he?
Right. Oh, you know? Right.
And the thing is, that's incitement. I mean, let's face it, if tonight you and I titled this stream How to Burn insert anyone from a ethnic minority background, say, you know, and I'm not going to say anyone's name because I don't want to get this stream into any trouble, but if we said something like that, how long would it be before this stream was taken down? And how long would it be before at least one or two online publications, if not actual print publications, called for our arrest for incitement? He was saying how to burn a Nazi. And he kept changing, they kept changing the name of it as well. At one point, it was how to burn a Nazi in real life. You know, what's that even mean? That he wants to come and burn my house down with my kid in the house. Absolute madness. Now, I still didn't really react to that. I went on a few places. I said it was terrible, but I didn't attack him. I said, look, it's been done when he's in prison. I don't want to get in there and attack him. Now, when I changed, when I finally snapped, when I finally started saying something about him, was when he took people's money for a documentary called The Rape of Britain and released a documentary called Shalom. Now, that is the most disgusting anti-British bait and switch nationalism has seen in probably forever. It's absolutely despicable. Then all of a sudden he starts making videos about me saying I don't have kids, I need to go out there and have sex. Just absolute pathetic rants. You know, he's very cowardly because he won't debate me. You know, he's all well and good when he stood there behind, you know, two dozen members of the Football Lads Alliance with a megaphone in his hand, but he wouldn't come on stream and debate me about Israel or anything else.
Honestly, if Tommy Robinson debated you, he'd be completely fucked.
Thank you.
I'm not just saying that because you're a friend of mine. It's obvious. And I think he knows that. I think he has enough he has enough awareness to realize that's what would happen. So all they can do is make these bitchy wee videos, hoping that I actually heard about a different guy doing this, a similar thing, where he on a YouTuber that I won't name, and he knew that he cannot debate this guy who's he's arguing with. So instead, what he does is he makes unlisted videos for his subscribers, in which he pretends to own this guy who he doesn't want to see these videos. And that's his idea. I mean, Tommy's doing a similar thing.
Oh, this YouTuber you're talking about, is he the one that sits on the end of his sofa next to a girl who wants to have nothing to do with him, and he just sits there staring at her longingly, buying her pizza and soft drinks, hoping that one day she'll notice him, but she never did, then kicked him out, and now he doesn't do streams with her anymore?
Possibly.
He'll really hate me saying that.
Right, good. Well, there we are. And I think Tommy's doing a similar thing, and it's all he can do. I actually, you know, with my empathy, I almost feel sorry for him, but I also think, look, I've defended him in the past, you know, and now he's done this. So it's time for him to go, basically. He should just stop. And if not, and if he won't do it, then he should be discredited by force.
No, of course. And the sad thing about this, and again, this is genuinely sad, this isn't a laughing matter, he's going to people who are the most oppressed, downtrodden people in Britain, who have the worst quality of life and are facing the most horrific problems. They're facing their daughters being sexually abused, and when they go to the police and the authorities, they themselves are threatened with arrest. He's going to those people and he's asking them for money. He's giving them a ray of hope. And these people believed in him and they dug deep. And a lot of these people live on the breadline, but they all found £10, £20. They all dug deep for him so he could tell their story. And what did he do with that money? Well, there's lots of rumours. There's lots of allegations of where that money went. But one thing we know for sure is it went on a documentary which had nothing to do with the grooming gang, which in fact tries to pivot the whole issue of multicultural society to make it look like the primary victims of interracial violence and of this multicultural society are in fact the people who created this multicultural society. What a disingenuous bait and switch. And the guy in question, anyone that looks into the history of this guy who apparently died because of the bullying, you will find out he is an actor, and he is a man who clearly had, at the very least, severe mental problems. And I believe he was making up the vast majority of what he said. This isn't a credible story. This is a story meant to basically totally reorientate the argument on multiculturalism. And it makes me sick to my stomach, because all of these people who have faced genuine hell, who have seen their children abused, who thought their stories were going to be heard, well, their stories aren't going to be heard now because they've been conned. And that is very, very sad.
It's reprehensible. It's disgusting, really, what Tommy's done there. I also think that just in general, his position, what he does, what he has been doing, is really off the 2000s and early 2010s and just feels completely obsolete now. It feels like, I mean, it was always artificial. He was always artificially holding people back from, you know, real nationalism. That it was always a kind of illusion of rebellion or whatever, or an illusion of patriotism. But at this point, it's so obviously, it's so painfully an illusion, and he's so obviously holding people back. And you can only feel sorry for those people who are still taken in by it, those people who are still loyal to him, because it's all a waste of time. And I think that this is something that I didn't predict. I didn't realize how quickly we would discredit him and his, well, not even him, but the people around him. But it's happened over the last few months. I think maybe the trigger event was that debate that you did with the four the four people. That was maybe the start of it. And I think it's probably going to snowball. And that seems an appropriate term to use in relation to Tommy Robinson. just an accident there. So I think it will probably snowball. And I think it's just right on time. I think it's great that it's happening.
I do, and I just hope that the good people, because we've already seen wonderful people like Shazia Hobbs and Dion Moller and many, many others sort of come over and start talking to us. Chris from TR Talk. I mean, I had a debate with James Goddard the other night, and James is, you know, he's been talking to me since. He's a really nice guy, and it's very telling what people say when they speak to us. People say, "We were a bit scared to come and speak to you because the Tommy lot told us that you were really nasty, harsh people, and you were going to roast us and chew us up and really do us down. And it was going to be, you were aiming to humiliate us." And after they've spoken to us, they're like, "Wow, your guys are so nice. I've been getting messages from your guys all week saying, oh, we'd like to talk to you more. Maybe come to our event if you want to learn more. We'll talk to you." But on the other side, they're like, "But now we've talked to you. All these Tommy guys that said you guys were the bad guys, they're just abusing us. They're just sending us death threats." And you really do get the measure of how nasty some of these hardcore Tommy fans are and how quickly they are to threaten violence or worse just because people are talking to us.
I mean, it's like a cult. But worse than that, it's you see how desperate they are. As it falls apart and is obviously a load of rubbish, they become ever more desperate to keep believing in it because they don't want to believe that they've been taken. I mean, no one ever wants to believe that they've been taken in and, you know, they've spent 5 years supporting this guy who's basically a fraud. So they've got to keep believing. It's like a test of their faith, actually. You know, now more than ever, we've got to stick by Tommy. But that's just, the ship is sinking, I think.
It certainly is. And some of the people he's got left as his mouthpieces supporting him online. I mean, there was one who I think he made about 5 streams in one day about Laura. And I remember watching one of them. He was raging about Laura. And he says, "Well, you know, who is she? You know, she's got her facts and statistics, but what else has she got?" And he's like,
good one.
This is how they actually think. You know, this is actually what these people think. And in a way that makes it, you know, that takes it from being a comedy to being a tragedy, because these people, they are being conned by somebody who understands exactly who he's conning. And I've got to say this as well, and this is going to make you laugh. It should do. At one point I heard that Tommy Robinson had been done for mortgage fraud. Now, at the time I heard of Tommy being done for mortgage fraud, and I'm just going to look this up as I'm speaking to you so I can give you the exact quote. Tommy had always maintained that this wasn't a proper thing. This was like absolute rubbish. You know, he wasn't really done for mortgage fraud. He was just helping out his brother or helping somebody out who was a member of his family. And he made out like, oh, well, getting a mortgage is difficult. Sometimes you act as a guarantor and you sort of fudge the figures a bit. But as long as you make the payments, have you really broken the law? As if it was just something that, you know, normal people do. And they came down hard on him because of who he is. But I want to read you this. Judge Andrew Bright, QC, described Tommy Robinson as the instigator, if not the architect, of some of the frauds. Passing sentence, the judge told him, this was an operation which was fraudulent from the outset and involved a significant amount of forward planning. He described Robinson as a fixer who had introduced others to fraudulent mortgage broker Deborah Rothschild.
Oh my God.
And there you have it. It's almost like that every single time, you know, and Tommy makes out that he, you know, that we're conspiracy theorists, that we see these people, you know, behind sort of, you know, behind every, you know, every rock, every lamppost, every corner, we're seeing these people and we should be mocked because, you know, we're paranoid cranks. But there you have it. Even when he's found guilty of committing mortgage fraud, the person he's doing it on behalf of is Deborah Rothschild. You can't even make this up.
No, you couldn't make it up. I mean, you couldn't make it up that, you know, when he misuses his funds to do a completely different documentary, it's one called Shalom. You wouldn't bother to make that up if you were trying to paint someone who's, you know, bought and sold or bought and paid for. You wouldn't do it that obviously, and yet it has happened that obviously. It really is farcical.
It is, and it's also sort of very, very sad how sort of shameless they are when they do it. I mean, as I say, I think over the next year, we'll see where that operation goes. But I predict with the amount of impending sort of legal problems, with the fact that they're losing so many subscribers on Telegram now every week, so many people are seeing through it, so many people want something more professional that's actually going somewhere. I think it's on dodgy ground. And let's face it, he built the EDL and it collapsed very quickly. He built up Pegida in the UK and it collapsed very quickly. And the only thing that is keeping the TR movement from completely collapsing is a small group of cosmopolitans who are, you know, busily editing his website to ensure that it's always exactly on point with the Israel First agenda. They're the only ones keeping him afloat.
That's cosmopolitans as opposed to metropolitans, which is what I am. As confessed earlier.
Metropolitan, not cosmopolitan. That should be your election cry.
All right. Okay, shall we do the super chats then? I think, yeah. Or is there anything else that we could talk about?
I think we've had a great run tonight. Are you using entropy?
Yes. Yes,
is that how you're doing it? Yeah, yes. Great.
Yeah, it's going well so far. This has been a first for me, both in using StreamYard and in using Entropy, and it's worked out very well so far. So, yeah, very good. All right, here's... I'll do the questions. Remember, if you want to post questions or super chats, please do it now. Now is the time. Okay. Mark, how is it moving along with Patriotic Alternative being acknowledged as a political party?
It's been... Well, all the paperwork went in a long time ago to the Electoral Commission, and we heard back from the Electoral Commission just before the election saying that all new parties or new party registrations were going to be paused because of the election. So the Electoral Commission at the moment will be dealing with a huge volume of paperwork and election returns. I should imagine they'll be doing that for a little while. And as soon as we hear back, I will let you know.
Okay, just so the folk know, you can post free questions on Entropy as well, so, and then they can get voted up, and it's really good, it's a great system. You can also do polls, but I haven't done that yet. I might do it later for one of the other streams. Okay, maybe this is a Sargon tier question, but where do mixed well, I'm still not convinced that Sargon is mixed race, but anyway,
he's maybe, not.
But where do mixed race people stand in the movement and in the movement's vision for the future?
Well, there are mixed race people who come to our events. There are mixed race people who appear on streams. We had mixed race people at our first conference, at our Christmas dinners, and we really don't have a problem with them. You know, the fact is, I believe that people are much better sticking to their own. I believe that mixing races is not good for the people who do it. It's not good for the children created from mixed race couples. And I also believe that the majority of people of a mixed race background tend to gravitate towards their non-white parent rather than their white parent. For example, you know, Barack Obama described himself as the first black president. Well, he was mixed race. Look at Meghan Markle. Most people at a glance would probably believe she's white, but she is mixed race and she gravitates towards her black mother, not her white father. And that's even odder when you read the truth of the matter, that her white father was the one who essentially funded her acting career in its infancy and gave her huge amounts of money and made sure she was looked after. But she still gravitates towards the black side of her family. But there are a small number of mixed race people who gravitate towards the white side of their family, who, you know, obviously do have a degree of ethnic European heritage. And they want to join us in our struggle. They want to make sure we remain in the majority. And I've got no problem at all with them being on board. I certainly don't want to discriminate against them. People like that attend our meetings. They're welcome at our meetings. And anyone that's been to our meetings will know that that doesn't cause any animosity or problems at all.
Right, indeed. Someone asked, he said, I'm 97% European. Am I mixed race? Nah, I mean, and unless the other 3% is Martian or something like that, I think we can assume that it's, you know, it's not going to make much of a dent. All right, the next one. Will we see any more instances of dissidents being banned and deported, like what happened to Greg Johnson at Scanza, simply for speaking? Yes. Well, I mean, there was a glut of that happening in early 2018 with, well, not speakers, but dissident activists, Lauren Southern, Brittany Pettibone, Martin Selner, Jared Taylor and Richard Spencer are also banned from Britain. I'm sure that there are more. But there was a glut of them happening in early 2018. As far as I know, nothing since then in Britain. Now, Mark, do you know
I know people have been banned from the UK, and I think people will continue to be banned from the UK. This, none of that surprises me. I think we have to brace ourselves for that. And when we leave the European Union, we have to brace ourselves for people like myself and Colin not being allowed to go to Europe.
Yeah, I think that's probably what will happen eventually. And it's annoying, but it's just, I mean, to be honest, I do love Britain, so it's nice to be here. All right. If you could give just one piece of advice for how to get involved and make a difference, what would it be?
One piece of advice. Whew. How to get involved and make a difference. And it's only just one piece of advice. Well, just talk to people. Talk to people that you know and introduce them to the normie-friendly topics. You know, people forget, or people have lost the ability to, chat. People today, because they're so trapped behind screens, always looking at their phone, people have lost conversational skills. Build your conversational skills and just chat to people. You will find that the vast majority of people in Britain today hold at least one or more views that have something in common with what we believe in. By talking to those people, you will convert people. You will win people over. That's the best way to make, you know, small everyday moves towards a better world.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot more that could be said about that, like talking to people, how to go about it, which people to talk to. I think we might have different views on that, but, you know, we have to, I want to wrap up fairly quickly, so we'll skip that for now. What are the long-term goals of PA? Are you guys going to run in general elections, or is it just a local party?
I think we've sort of went over that earlier. I mean, really, you know, obviously, eventually we want to hit general elections. But, you know, in the short to medium term, it's all about community building and getting to a position where we could do something at local level. You know, there's this sort of failed mentality in it. And Farage falls for this every time. I mean, how many parties has he built up that then go hell for leather, do well in a European election, which is a sort of a totemic election, which, you know, built for, you know, parties like his to do well. But then without getting any local representation, he flies straight into a general election, wastes hundreds of thousands of pounds, gets 2%, folds the party, starts a new one. What's the point?
Yeah, indeed. I don't really know what goes on in his head, to be honest. Someone said the Gillette advert is being used in schools to educate boys on masculinity. The indoctrination is deep. Really, you know, I can't really say what I want to say about this, but I'll just say it's outrageous. The idea of that being used as any kind of teaching material on masculinity is just awful. And the people involved will hopefully be held responsible one day.
Agreed.
Okay, someone says, have a pint on me, Woz. Thanks for putting all this together and for the quality of guests this year. Well, thank you very much. I mean, it is a different thing this year. I didn't make it open to people to apply. I invited people that I wanted. So it's a bit different this year. I don't know what I'll do next year. Anyway, thank you. Someone else says, thank you, Woz, for all your work. Hail Mark.
Thank you.
All right. It's have another pint on me, Woz, or a couple of iron brews. Regarding zombie parties, a while back, a friend joined a certain organization that has obviously gone very downhill. Okay, thank you. All right. It's a matter of public record that Nigel Farage has watched the Iconoclast content. I don't know. I don't know about this. This is the first I've heard of it. To what extent do you believe the alt-right has influenced the political class? That's a really interesting question.
I hear things. People do tell me that so-and-so has watched one of my videos. And I have been very, very lucky in that I am one of those people that manages to write tweets that get retweeted by people who probably shouldn't be retweeting me for the good of their careers. Katie Hopkins has retweeted me. There's been US senators that have retweeted me. The other week, I think it's Michelle Malkin from the US. She retweeted me over the JQ. And it's quite interesting. And you sort of wonder, do any of those people, if they're retweeting you, how many of those people check out your account, watch a video? Because there is obviously the chance that they're doing that. And I think they are. I mean, I'm not one of those people who believes that Donald Trump's secretly watching my videos or Nigel Farage sits down every Friday at 1 p.m. to devour my latest video. You know, that'd be absolute. You know, people who think like that are just obviously insane and deluding themselves. But to think that somebody in some position of power has watched one of my videos, well, that certainly isn't beyond the realms of reality, I don't think.
Yeah, I agree. I don't really have much to say about this, but I think that definitely it is having an effect and will only continue to have an effect. I mean, dissident, this stuff is obviously going to have an effect, either directly or indirectly, consciously or unconsciously, implicitly or explicitly. Yes, of course, everything has effects. Everything has shockwaves, repercussions. So yes, the short answer is yes, of course. There's probably a lot more that could be said about it, but yeah, I'll just leave it at that. Okay. Are you familiar with Jay Dyer, Economic Invincibility, or Aaron Cleary? Aaron Cleary. If you are, please give your thoughts on them. I know that Woz knows at least Aaron Cleary. I don't know him, but I know of Aaron Cleary. He's, I can't remember. Captain Capitalism, was that his name? These people are very American in their outlook, Aaron Cleary at least. I find it very difficult to identify with them. So I don't have anything to say about that. Jay Dyer, I know the name, but I can't remember anything about him. I haven't heard of Economic Invincibility. Mark?
I've only heard of Jay Dyer, and I've actually been on a stream with him. I believe we've both been on the Kill stream at the same time. I've actually spoken to him. He seems like a really nice guy, but I don't know enough about him to make any further comment.
Right. Okay. And finally, Your thoughts on the idea of an international coalition of European people that protects global white interests? Will this an international coalition to protect global white interests, like an international ADL for white people, will this become more or less feasible when the individual nations become minority white? Oh, that's a good question.
I think things like that are obviously a very good idea. And I love working with people on the continent. However, and this is a big however, we're not quite in the position where some international coalition will actually have any effect. At the moment, we need to focus on building parties or groups in each of our constituent nations. You know, if I went and knocked on people's doors in the street and said, oh, do you know who Patriotic Alternative is? No. Oh, but we are twinned with the International Coalition of White Wellbeing. They'd just be like, you know, and I think these ideas are great, but they're the kind of ideas that work better when you're already getting to some degree of power. So, for example, say two groups like the AFD in Germany and the Front National in France came together and worked together in some kind of coalition, that would be good. And they do that in the European Parliament. But there is also an issue with things like that, in that a huge amount of effort can go into them, but the actual payoff at local level, or tangible payoff, is never great. You know, they're great on paper, but ultimately, at the moment, I don't think any group of people on our level of nationalism, is powerful enough in any European country to really start that kind of group and make it work in any tangible manner. I don't know what you think, Woz.
I think it would simply depend on the people involved, because I think that we do need, I've said in previous millennials this year, we do need some sort of organization to defend our interests on social media, to the extent that you want to defend your interests on social media. Some people might think that's a trivial concern. I think it's a vital concern. We do need some kind of organization that will inevitably be international in order to pursue those interests. But it will depend on the people involved in it, because it has to be bloody good quality people who embark on something like that. So that's a short, but I think salient answer to that question. All right. Well, that's it. So there aren't any more super chats. Okay. So Mark, closing remarks.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on. This has been the comfiest stream I've ever done. To be able to do this on camera in a dressing gown and t-shirt, I feel truly at ease. And also, I much prefer having the big headset on than those stupid little bud things in the ear. They really annoy me. So this has been fantastic fun. It's been very comfortable. The audience has been fantastic. I just want to say thank you to everyone who stayed up for it. And I hope everyone has a really, really lovely Christmas and New Year. And I hope you'll be joining myself and Colin at future Patriotic Alternative events, and I hope we can build something that will truly do the best for our people and be a new dawn for nationalism, not only in Britain, but hopefully a shining light to other nationalists across the world to how to do things in a successful manner.
Yeah, I think I'll end by, I want to say that I think there is a lot of change coming in Britain, and I think that there are a lot of shills who are going to get supplanted, deposed, both in the online sphere and in you know, the real life. And I think that this is an exciting time, and it's going to be a scary time, including for me. And I might have, you know, I might not always be as optimistic about it as I feel just now. It's going to be a strange, this next decade is going to be fucking weird. Sorry, I've gone through this entire stream without swearing, and then I went and did it. Sorry, Mark. It's going to be a strange decade, but we need to stick together, and that's all I would say about this. I mean, I think that's right now, that's probably the most important thing to say. So, okay, let's leave it at that. And I just have this feeling that there's a sort of new start happening here, quite organically, and I think it's time for it. So, all right. Okay, let's leave it at that. So, Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay, that was Mark Collett, and I will be back in a wee while, maybe 10-15 minutes, with my third guest tonight. Orwell and Good was saying to me earlier that his internet is messing up, so he might not be able to make it. So it's possible that I will not be back in 10 or 15 minutes. But either way, I will be back in 2 hours with On the Offensive. So, all right. See you then.